Hello, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders for you today, but before we get into that, I just want to let you know about Spiked's very exciting new daily newsletter. It's called Today on Spiked. Sent out every day at 6 p.m, it gives you your essential roundup of all of the content that we've published that day, along with exclusive commentary from the Spiked team that you won't read elsewhere. And it is also completely 100% free. We're publishing more and more these days, so if you want to make sure that you never miss an article or an essay or a podcast, stop what you're doing right now and go to spiked-online.com/newsletters and sign up to Today on Spiked. Once again, that's spiked-online.com/newsletters and Today on Spiked. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, the nanny state and censorship, and for a while longer at least, COVID and lockdown. In this episode, we discuss the Delta variant and the calls to delay Freedom Day, the culture war hitting English cricket, and the plans for a smoke-free Britain. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am every month, by Chris Snowden, Director of Lifestyle Economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Hello, listeners.
And today we're delighted to be joined for a second appearance on the show by Julia Hartley Brewer, known to many of you, I'm sure, as a journalist, broadcaster, and of course, the breakfast show host at Talk Radio. Julia, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much. I think I'm known to some other people by some other words we can't use on the podcast.
Hopefully we'll get into that a little bit. So we're going to kick off today by talking about an issue that I know you've talked about loads on your show, Julia. Obviously, it's been the defining issue since you were last on the show, of lockdown and restrictions and potentially the end of most of them, with Freedom Day coming up on the 21st of June. There's been some noises out of government in the past couple of days that this might actually be delayed amid concerns about the Indian variant, aka the Delta variant. Matt Hancock saying over the weekend that they're open to the prospect of delaying it for a couple of weeks. So, Julia, just to kick things off, do you think there's any justification for delaying the 21st of June reopening, and what chance do you think there is of them actually kicking it back a couple of weeks?
Short answer, no, there is no justification. What chances? God, I'd say 50-50 right now. I'm pretty negative about this. I mean, the absolutely extraordinary thing is the number of people who say to me, but we're not in lockdown. You can do pretty much anything you want. What are you talking about? We're allowed out of our homes. And I think, oh, gosh, thanks ever so much. I'm allowed to leave my home when I want. Wow, I'm so grateful. Let me write a letter of thank you. Let me write a little thank you card with little dotted, you know, hearts all over it to the Prime Minister and Matt Hancock for that. I'm despairing. I have been despairing since January the 4th this year. And I know some people have been despairing a lot longer than that. The idea that the lockdown, once again, to protect the NHS, when the NHS's job is to protect us, and also that I always knew that it wasn't going to be for a matter of a few weeks while the over 70s were vaccinated. I always knew it would take longer than that. It became the over 70s, then it was the over 50s. That's the latest scam. Well, as soon as all the under 50s had their second jab, then we'll be fine. It'll be the over 40s next, and the over 30s, over 20s. Even if we do get some freedoms back on June the 21st, it won't be all of them. There'll still be face masks and some social distancing, some limits on major events. And I think it's ridiculous. A, it's ridiculous because we've got an unofficial zero COVID policy, which is impossible to achieve and therefore insane. B, because the costs of achieving that are way beyond the benefits of achieving it. And see, because the data is really clear. If we're going on the data, not dates, the data says that we have broken the link between people getting COVID or, well, testing positive for COVID, many of whom don't even have a single symptom, and people ending up in hospital needing treatment, let alone ICU, let alone dying. We see that in the stats from Bolton, even with the Indian variant. I don't understand why anyone who wasn't just loving the fact that they're having control over other people's lives would want lockdown to continue for one moment, one nanosecond past June the 21st.
And Chris, what's your take on all of this? Has the Indian variant changed things? Is there any justification for delaying, or is this just more caution on the part of the government, hyper caution, you could say?
Well, all of those things, really. I mean, if I had to carry water for the government, I suppose I could say that June the 21st was always supposed to be the earliest date. And one of the things they said might knock that back would be a new variant. And thanks to Boris Johnson not securing the borders properly, we have got this variant, which is a genuine problem, far as I can see. However, I don't think it should actually change anything. I don't think it should change the roadmap at all because of what Julia says. It has, you know, we've broken the link. And so long as hospital admissions are not, you know, in their kind of thousands a day, I don't think there's any justification for any restrictions, really. I think actually, you know, whether you call it lockdown or not, what's left to be undone isn't actually, most of it isn't that big a deal. As far as I can see, epidemiologically, it's not very important. Economically, it's quite important, particularly for pubs, because we still got, like, the majority of people who work for pubs are still furloughed. They have seen a massive drop in business thanks to the government mucking around with them with all this nonsense over the last 15 months. And it's not just about pubs. There's obviously nightclubs and other parts of the nighttime economy. And of course, there are other bits as well. And people want to meet indoors. People want to have weddings with more than however many people you can have at the moment. So I guess the thing is, it's sort of, there's an in for a penny, in for a pound element to this now, which is that, yeah, cases are going up, and it's very annoying that cases are going up at this particular moment in time, and they didn't in Israel, and I hope that they wouldn't do very much here. Hospitalizations, touch wood, are not going up, and deaths certainly are not going up. But if we are going to have a third wave, I think there's enough stuff open already for that to happen. And clearly the fact that, you know, the number of cases has doubled in a couple of weeks shows that it can happen. I personally think it will peter out. But either way, surely nobody thinks that the restrictions we have now are the kind of sweet spot for controlling this virus. And if people are allowed to buy a drink at the bar, it's going to be a game changer. So I just think we should stick to our guns. We should hold our nerve. We could trust the science. A lot of these people who want to put things back, put the roadmap back, sound to me a bit like anti-vaxxers. Certainly they give succor to anti-vaxxers, because the whole thing is, you know, everyone knows that like 99% of the people who have any real chance of dying from this thing have been doubly vaccinated. 53% have had two doses, 70-odd% have had one dose, and millions of people have had COVID-19. So we might not quite be at the point of herd immunity, but we can't be very far off. And if you believe that the vaccines work, as I do, and they're extremely effective, including against the Indian variant, then we got to accept that there's going to be a rise in cases here or there, hopefully isolated pockets of the country, but there is no justification for further infringing civil liberties. You know, this is a health issue now. It's not a civil liberties issue anymore. It shouldn't be.
But we are running way below, as in better than, the worst case scenarios of you know, Warwick and Imperial, the scenarios on which basis we started coming out of lockdown. I had someone on my talk radio show the other day saying, well, you know, we shouldn't move too quickly. I went, it's bloody June. It's June. We went into lockdown on the 4th of January. How slow do you want it to be? And it seems very clear to me it's not data and it's not dates that are ruling all of this. It is public opinion and an entire nation that has been basically terrified into its homes. People who are utterly hysterical about seeing anyone go to a pub or get on a plane. Terrified, you know, people who wear masks in broad daylight or, you know, walking down the street on their own. Those people. There are millions of them. They've been watching nothing but the BBC and Sky. They think if they put a toe out of their off their front step, that millions of people are going to die. Those people are now running policy. It's not based on the science anymore, because the science would tell us, capital T, capital S, as we've been listening to it for the last year, that people are always going to die of COVID. It's now an endemic disease. And as Chris says, the vaccines, my God, they work beyond the scientists' wildest dreams when they were developed. And people are taking them beyond the scientists' and the politicians' wildest dreams. There is no justification. We were supposed to be out of this when the over 70s were double jabbed. I'm 53. I've now been double jabbed. I don't think that if I had to spend an extra couple of weeks being extra careful, which I don't believe I need to do, that everyone else in the country should have to stay at home for me. I mean, it is utterly absurd that we are looking at restricting people's, not just people's freedoms, being able to go on holiday, you know, meet up with who they want, have seven people in their home legally. Everyone's doing it illegally, but legally, businesses to be able to actually stay afloat. It's not just pubs. It's pubs, restaurants, nightclubs, cinemas, theatres, museums, art galleries, all tourism, all travel, hotels. It is a huge multi-billion pound cost to our society that is brought about by not being allowed to have the freedoms that we are supposed to get back on June the 21st. And people do say, well, it's all right for me because I can go to the pub and I can have a few mates over. I'm fine. Well, good for you. But when half the businesses in your local area close down because they can't break even, maybe you'll feel differently about it.
And Chris, before we move on, I mean, is it just the case that the government have become incapable of talking about any level of COVID risk? I mean, you know, the way in which there's been so much discussion about vaccine hesitancy, despite the fact we have the lowest rates of that practically in the world, concern about, again, the vaccines constantly stressing they're not 100% effective when no vaccine is 100% effective and these are actually pretty good. Is part of this nervousness just the fact that, as Julia said, people have been so scared stiff and that the government feels very uneasy even admitting that this is a problem that we will deal with in the long term? It won't kill many people, thankfully, but it will kill some, and that's what opening up and getting on with our lives means. It's about bringing it down to a manageable level. Have they just rendered themselves incapable of making that kind of point to the public?
I think the nervousness comes from seeing the case numbers ticking up and that sense of deja vu that we, you know, remember from October and then December, both occasions thinking, well, this will probably flatten out. Yeah, fingers crossed. And it didn't, you know, it did a little bit actually in October, but certainly didn't in December. And so even though we can kind of logically think it through and go, okay, it doesn't matter that much that cases are going up, there's still that fear. And because we are one of the most vaccinated countries in the world, we are finding things out. You know, we're part of the natural experiment. We haven't got that many other countries to look at and say, okay, we know what to expect here. So that's, I think, where the nervousness is. To be fair to the government, and by the time this podcast comes out, they may well have, you know, cancelled June the 21st completely. But so far, they have actually been pretty good at standing up to Imperial and Warwick and Sage. You know, they didn't want to open the schools, but the government opened the schools on time. They didn't want to do the reopening in April or May, but the government did both. And at the moment, you know, we're recording this, apparently Boris Johnson doesn't see anything in the data to change his mind about June the 21st either. So, you know, we shall see. But thank God, actually, they have stood up to the scientists, certainly since around about March.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. We could talk about COVID for this entire podcast. There's so much going on, but I really want to move on to some culture war stories, which is really come roaring back into focus, particularly in British sport. So in the past week, we've had Ollie Robinson being suspended from international cricket over tweets that he posted as a teenager. Meanwhile, the taking the knee scandal in football has continued to rumble on. But let's start with Robinson first. Julia, what did you make of this? I mean, this was, what, just less than 10 years ago, 18, some idiotic kind of racist and sexist jokes, really, and yet he's been suspended for it. And the position of a lot of people is that that's completely fine and fair enough and justified. What do you make of all of this?
Oh, yes. lots of people seem to think, yes, you should absolutely ruin someone's entire life, reputation and career because of something they did when they were 18. Those people aren't very nice people. I'm glad I wasn't at school with a lot of these people because, wow, they would have made your life hell, wouldn't they, for one thing you happened to do on the first day at primary school. They're bullies is what these people are. I'm genuinely shocked. This poor lad, he, you know, has his very first day getting his cap for England, and he expected to go to a wonderful press conference and then discovers that his past is being brought up against him and he's now being suspended. This is just vicious, vile bullying of the worst kind. The idea that stuff that you did when you were 18 should be held against you years later in your career, and I think is really quite scary. And I don't think many of us, certainly most politicians, would survive that. Most of them can't survive what happened last week, let alone 8 years ago. But also, I take issue with these characterisation of these racist, sexist, offensive tweets. Well, I'm a woman. I wasn't offended by any of the tweets about women. They were the sort of thing I would expect an 18-year-old bloke to be saying or writing about women. Women say far worse about men on a daily basis, and no one bats an eyelid. I do have an issue, obviously, with some, but not all, of the tweets that have been categorised as racist, some of them using the N-word, but not to someone, and some of the other things, clearly trying to make jokes. But they weren't, you know, nasty, hate-filled, abusive tweets to someone, abusing someone because of their colour. They were ignorant, and they were stupid. And yes, some of them were racist. But the idea that in some way that that should earn you a suspension from your job 8 years later when they're dredged up, I think just shows the total lack of backbone of the ECB. I'm very impressed with the Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, who spoke out about this very early on. Boris Johnson jumped on the bandwagon when he realised that would be a popular move. But again, we're into the same territory as well with taking the knee. With, if you don't think he should be suspended, it's because you're a racist yourself. So everyone's in a no-win situation. But this is just the culture wars taking down another victim, and they're just sort of wiping the blood from their chins, and they're going for the next person.
What do you think about this, Chris? Do we need almost like a kind of informal statute of limitations on things people posted donkeys years ago to avoid this kind of thing?
Might be an idea, yeah. I mean, it seems to me that this climate of puritanism that we now live in, this movement of puritanism, it's a sort of religion without forgiveness, isn't it? You know, I only saw a handful of these tweets. I kind of shared Julia's view of them. They're stupid and somewhat offensive. But, you know, the guy has apologized for them. I don't know if many people are suggesting he was actually a racist. But, I mean, even if he was a fully paid-up racist, can't people change and be forgiven? You know, if he'd said, look, I used to be racist, I held some very, you know, backwards opinions, but I deeply regret it now, and that's not the person I am, then why wouldn't we forgive him? Or do we have to wait a certain amount of time? You know, is there 6 months you've got to be suspended for, and then you get forgiven? I don't know. It seems all rather mean-spirited. It is a big problem, and people have been saying this for years about social media, about how you're just going to end up with people in public life who have no personality because they never made any mistakes or said anything vaguely controversial. And I remember, you know, 10 years ago, I think it was Mark Wallace said that he suspected that what would happen would be that because everyone had said regrettable things on Facebook and Twitter in the past, it wouldn't matter anymore and we'd become much more tolerant of it. But of course, that's not what's happened. What happened is you've got offense archaeologists going through your old stuff. So, you know, my advice is clear out your social media feed every few years at the very least, because no one is safe.
Sage advice, definitely. We should touch on the taking the knee aspect as well, because that is something which is turning into more and more of a circus at the moment. So all these months later, football teams across the UK continuing to take the knee before games. Obviously, it came to a point in recent days with the England team's European warm-up games against Austria and then Romania, with fans booing. Gareth Southgate and the team really doubling down. The implication always being that those people booing this kind of gesture are doing it because they're against lowercase Black Lives Matter, if you like. They're just racist. But Julia, what do you make of that? Where does this kind of conviction that the only reason that these fans could be booing this is not because they're being lectured to at the start of every football match, it's definitely because they're racist?
Yes, if you do not use the correct wording, and if you do not agree to the correct gesture at the correct time and virtue signaling the right way, by definition you must be a racist, because those are the rules are now. Now, I endorse the fans booing. I really do, and I think I'd probably be booing. I don't think we need to mix politics and sport. I mean, I know there's an element of that. You're always going to have that with World Cups and Olympics, because they are essentially political events these days, aren't they? But I think we should get as much politics out of sport as possible. I think, look, they all know. If they just did the linking arms thing, you know, we're all together, you know, every ethnicity against racism, fans would be cheering. I'm not even sure they need to do that. That doesn't mean I endorse the racist abuse of Black or Asian players. Of course I don't. It's horrific. Those people should be kicked off social media. They should probably be prosecuted if they're making threats. But there is a very big grey area in between these things. I think it would be really nice to go to any sporting event and not have people lecture me on my morals just a few minutes beforehand, least of all multi-millionaire footballers. I think it's quite bizarre that this has taken on the life that it has. The fact that it happened in here in England in the first place was bizarre. And Colin Kaepernick taking the knee, saying, I won't stand for the national anthem when this is a country which has a police force which is, you know, killing my fellow black men and women. He was making a very specific point about the American police force and the American government failing to deal with that issue of violence against young black men and women. Sorry, we do not have that issue in this country. We've imported a gesture about something that is happening on the other side of the Atlantic. It's got no place here whatsoever. Forget the Marxist, lunatic, nasty organisation that Black Lives Matter is. I don't think it's got any place at the start of a football match. And that's what the fans are saying. We don't want to be lectured. We just want to come and watch you play football. And that doesn't make people racist.
What about you, Chris? Would you be booing these players or are you a good person instead?
No, I'd be booing them. And I think it's quite good that people have all got masks to wear so the FA can't spot who's doing the booing. It's kind of like it's like humming in assembly. You know, the teacher won't be able to work out exactly who it is and bar you for life, which is presumably what the FA would like to do. I don't, like Julie, I don't think it has any place in the game. Apart from anything else, I think it's a way too ambiguous statement. I must admit, I still don't actually know exactly what taking a knee is supposed to represent. We've got a perfectly good anti-racism campaign in British football called Get Racism Out of Football, and that's as political as it needs to get. And if suddenly another organization called Kick Racism Out of Football started rioting in the streets and kicking people half to death and demanding the end of capitalism and the patriarchy, then I think we'd think twice about sticking up the words Kick Racism Out of Football. We'd have to find something else instead. So I don't know what the taking of me really represents. It's not clear whether we're paying tribute to a movement or to a statement of fact, which Black Lives Matter is just, you know, just a statement of fact. But there's clearly more to it than that. Taking the knee is a gesture of submission, first and foremost. And just from a sporting point of view, I don't think it's very good to be groveling at the start of a game and then getting booed by your own fans. It can't be good for morale at the start of an international football to start things off before a ball's even been kicked like that. So they had every chance to get rid of it. It'd been a year since George Floyd was murdered. They could have said, right, a year's enough. Obviously, you're not going to keep doing this forever and ever. No one else is still doing it, I don't think. I don't think there's any other sports where people are carrying on. So they had a great reason just to finish after a year and end with some kind of dignity. But what's going to happen? Of course, they're going to get getting booed. They'll get booed at home and away, and they're going to have to, you know, do a more sort of embarrassing climb down, I suppose.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's turn now to our kind of regular segment on the idiocies and potential corruption of the public health establishment. So we've talked a lot about the World Health Organization in recent months, and it's not had a good pandemic, I think it's fair to say. It's been accused specifically being too cozy with China, repeating the CCP's claims about the origins and nature of the virus in the early days, even playing a role in kind of suppressing the lab leak theory, which is a whole nother kettle of fish. But most recently, as you've written about, Chris, it's caught flak again for its coziness to some other authoritarian regimes, namely Syria and Belarus, who have been quietly appointed to its executive board. So could you tell us a little bit about this story and the WHO's slightly strange history with dictators of various different stripes?
Yeah, it had a cracking week last week. So firstly, it gave an award for it was No Tobacco Day on the 31st of May, I think. And they dished out an award to the health minister of India, who had been instrumental in getting e-cigarettes completely banned from sale in India, and thanked him for all his good work in keeping people smoking, presumably. Then they, as you say, appointed Syria and Belarus to their executive board. They were voted on, but I mean, they didn't have to be, you know, nominated in the first place. And obviously, since Belarus hijacked a plane and arrested a political dissident who is certainly being tortured, may very well be murdered, governments around the world have been thinking of things they can do to punish Belarus short of, you know, actually going to war with them and effectively Russia. And it's not very easy, but you know, the EU brought in some kind of sanctions. You know, the WHO responds by putting him on the executive board. It's kind of a weird thing to do. They're always honoring these horrible dictatorships. And I understand, you know, if you're a World Health Organization, you do have to deal with horrible dictatorships. You know, they do have to deal with China. They need to get information from these countries. And they also want to help, you know, the people who live in these countries. But there's a difference between being diplomatic with these people and, you know, paying tribute to them, giving them awards, giving them a seat at the table. It's just broken beyond repair, the World Health Organization. You know, its attitude towards vaping is just a kind of microcosm of how badly it's gone wrong. We don't need to go over all the stuff again with COVID and the numerous mistakes it made and the way it, you know, believed everything the Chinese Communist Party said and then gave the world appalling advice about travel bans and so on. But it's been getting everything wrong for a very long time. It's the worst aspect of UN corruption. And I don't know what we do about it other than just defund it and start again. I think Trump actually did the right thing. He did it for totally self-interested reasons, but he did the right thing in defunding it. Give the money to somebody else. We can set up another global surveillance organization that's going to do the job 10 times better than the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization can carry on getting money from China and giving people awards for banning e-cigarettes.
What do you think, Julia? Is it time to defund the WHO?
I think it's well past that time. like a lot of these organisations, once you've got the non-democratic countries involved, same with the United Nations, you end up constantly, well, for want of a better phrase, taking the knee to them. I mean, bearing in mind the World Health Organization's entire job was to save the world from any future pandemics. And yet, a little while ago, it said that they thought the biggest crisis facing the world was climate change. I mean, really, no evidence for that whatsoever. And that tells you how much politics rather than science and medical knowledge was actually in charge. There's just no doubt at all that they do not, as a body, and I think a lot of the very senior figures, have the interests of human beings, individual health, as their number one priority. This is clearly now a bureaucracy. We're in EU, United Nations territory, where the future of the bureaucracy is what matters more than anything else, and everyone's on a super duper wage and very highfalutin, and in normal times would be flying around the world and staying in 5-star hotels and being feted by everybody. And I'm afraid these organisations inevitably just get very top heavy, very self important, and they forget what they're there to do with our money.
Mm. The other thing they did, of course, was bring in these bloody stupid names for the variants of concern, which was, again, you know, they're obsessed with stigmatizing.
Yeah, well, no one minded the Kent variant, did they? The Kent variant was fine. The South African variant was fine. Indian variant. Oh,
there were guys from
Delta,
Medway getting
Delta.
Beaten up in the streets.
Yeah, right. The WHO repeatedly referred to the UK variant, and nobody had any problem with it whatsoever, and the South African variant, and the Brazilian variant. And then when the Indian variant came along, I think the Indian government basically complained to the WHO, just like the Chinese complained. And we ended up with COVID-19 as a name, because even SARS-2, which would be kind of a more obvious name, was still seen as being a bit too closely associated with China. So no other country, I don't think any Indian people were complaining about it. Certainly no British people were complaining about the UK variant being called that. And then we give an alpha, beta, delta. I mean, how many of those can you link to a variant of concern? I was down the snooker club at the weekend, and there were people talking about, oh God, we've got this new Delta variant now, as if the Indian variant wasn't already enough. It's confusing. This is what happens when you have censorship and political correct language. Mm. It makes things more difficult to understand, makes people more ignorant.
I know it was fascinating, your piece, Chris, that line from Dr. Tedros saying the real enemy here is stigma. That's the real threat to humanity
more
at
than
the start
virus.
Of all of this.
Stigma is what's been killing people and locking us in our homes. Absolutely.
Political correctness summed up, you know, it's about what you name the virus rather than how deadly it is. But there we go. So speaking of crazy priorities in public health, Chris, we can't not talk about this story out of Oxfordshire and this plan to make the streets smoke-free by 2025. You've written about this. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, well, the reality is that the Council of Oxfordshire, or their tobacco control people, they put out what in reality was a really very boring and bland sort of 8-page pamphlet about their hopes for people's health in Oxfordshire, which included, wouldn't it be nice if fewer people smoked? And wouldn't it be nice if fewer people, you know, smoked outside pubs and in their homes? And then thanks to a couple of comments from the Oxfordshire Public Health Director, everyone got into their head that Oxfordshire Council was banning smoking outdoors. It's not. It's very unlikely to in the future. The only council in that neck of the woods who've ever voted on it, right, voted resoundingly against it. The pubs and restaurant industry would be up in arms about it. The government, incidentally, has come out with a pretty decent, strong statement saying, we have absolutely no intention of doing this nationwide because the hospitality industry has invested so much in outdoor areas. So it's a bit of a non-starter, but I know the media love it. They love it because I get invited onto the TV and radio every time this idea comes up. Doesn't matter who suggested it. And you get, of course, all the cranks, all the people like Julia ring in saying, like, yeah, I ain't smoking, want to ban it outdoors. And I had half an hour with Nikki Campbell, in which Nikki Campbell seems a very, very fierce anti-smoker. And my view, which was that it would be excessive to ban smoking outdoors, was treated as a very eccentric position to take. I mean, and my view when he asked me, should we bring smoking back into pubs? And I said, well, if the landlord wants to, I think pubs should be able to have smoking sections, was treated as if it was literally insane, like the most ludicrous thing anybody could possibly say. So yeah, there's this sort of climate of like, what are we going to do next with smoking? We've got to get rid of it completely. And here's our thing we can do. And people who are, you know, incredibly sensitive to a waft of tobacco smoke outdoors because they've got nothing else to worry about much in life, like a pandemic, they ring into these radio shows and we all have to listen to them.
Julia, what are your thoughts? And if you want to respond to that outrageous charge,
Chris is going to get upset with me now. I see. I just find it extraordinary. And you know, I'm an avid listener to this podcast. Absolutely love it. But I was so disappointed in Chris supporting this lockdown in the early stages. Now you've realised the error of your ways, because as I told you, this is what was going to happen. It'll drag on forever. But I think it's extraordinary. You think that people should be locked in their homes and have all their liberties taken away and their livelihoods crushed. But you think it's totally unacceptable for someone to be stopped from smoking. And this is where we differ. You won't get a more avid anti-smoker than me, and yet even I think that what Oxfordshire County Council want to do is insane. Look, it would be nice, frankly, as a non-smoker and someone who can smell cigarette on someone about 4 miles away, it would be really nice when I sat in a pub garden or a restaurant garden that I didn't have to sit next to a smoker. I'm all in favour of separating the non-smoking and the smoking sections outdoors, but I certainly don't think it's reasonable to ban it completely outdoors. It'd be nice not to walk into an office building or certainly through into a hospital. That's always very bizarre, to have people standing outside dragging on their cigarettes as they're standing there in their hospital gowns. And so you shouldn't have to, it shouldn't be forced on you. But if we're going to have it as a legal product, which is still bizarre to me because it is a council stick, but if you're going to have it as a legal product, you can't make it impossible for people to use that product. Would seem to me to be a strange position for any council or government to take. And I'm not really sure it's the bloody local council's business to take those decisions.
And Chris, just finally, what's next for the kind of the public health industry, really, in relation to smoking? Will COVID have kind of emboldened them to take steps like this? This story, as it turns out, is a little bit on the confected side, but nevertheless, do you think they're going to just see how far they can push it in relation to stopping people smoking?
Yeah, always. Because the government under Theresa May suddenly adopted this plan to go tobacco free by 2030, which in practice means getting the smoking rate below 5%. It's currently about 14%. It's very unlikely that it will fall by that much by the end of the decade. But as you get closer to that totally arbitrary and undemocratic date, no one's
That's
really
unusual for a government.
The pressure groups will be going like, oh, the government has fallen short. It's never going to reach its target. We must do more. We must do more. So you've got Ash now saying we want to raise the smoking age to 21. There is a bit more of a push for these outdoor smoking bans, although so far they've never really amounted to anything. More and more tax on cigarettes. I mean, in reality, we've seen a big drop in smoking in the last 6 or 7 years, and it's been almost entirely down to vaping. If the government could get even more behind vaping than it already is and support, you know, forthcoming products that contain nicotine that smokers might enjoy, I think actually we can get down to 5%. Sweden has got down to 5% thanks to using snus. But you have to give people the carrot rather than the stick. The stick really has run its course. Mixing metaphors a bit there, but you know, we've tried battering smokers over the head. It's amazing in many respects that there's still so many smokers left, given £10 a pack of cigarettes and you can't smoke them anywhere. But no, giving people an enjoyable alternative, which is what worked for me. I'm now nearly 10 years I've been vaping. That's what's going to get us there. And you do it without coercion and making people's lives miserable.
Yeah, even as an anti-smoker, and I really am, I agree with every single word of that. We tried everything, encouraging people. I mean, goodness knows how much for NHS funds actually goes on efforts to try and stop people smoking, and we're told that that is a payoff. But actually, the biggest contribution smokers make isn't all that tax money that pays the NHS. It is very sweetly dying early and not claiming their pensions for so long. So I don't know what we're going to do with all those people who'd stop smoking and live so long.
What a place to end it.
Be careful what you wish for.
And now we got a vaccine for COVID as well. I mean, it just keeps going from bad to worse.
No, but that is the issue, isn't it? This thing is, we know what's happened during the pandemic. Once you've discovered that you can literally lock millions of people in their homes for 23 hours a day, as was the start of the first lockdown, you realise you can get away with pretty much anything. Anything that would be questioned in the past or have some sort of democratic mandate against it, that is going to go through. We are going to spend the next 10 years fighting back for all of our individual freedoms. The freedom to do things to your own body that might damage it because you choose to do so, I think it's a fairly fundamental human right, actually.
Excellent. Chris, Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated.